So we're in the catch, and this would relate to pretty much what you'd look for at the bottom of a front squat for a clean or an overhead squat for a snatch. But the stable components particularly will kind of translate into both. So the weight distribution ideally should be on the midfoot. So you don't want to be raising up on the heels or moving your weight too far back. And if you were to draw a line directly down from the bar, it should be over the middle of the foot, so directly over that base of support. Now, variable components will be the height at which you actually catch the bar. So some people may sit really deep into the hole because they have very good flexibility and very good strength. Some may not be able to do that, so they might sit a bit higher. And I think the most common one for being a variable component would be the foot position. So what foot position do people adopt when they catch? Naturally, your body will take the least path of resistance and will end up in the position where it feels strongest.
Lovely to meet you finally, and welcome to Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself, that would be great.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Alex. Appreciate it. So my name is Shyam Chowda. I'm a program lead for the Masters in Strength and Conditioning at Middlesex University, where I'm also the head weightlifting coach. My coaching career is just over a decade within the sport, where I've been fortunate enough to not only coach some great national lifters, but also coach at the Tokyo Olympic Games a few years back under the International Olympic Committee's refugee flag with Cyril Chatchett, who I continue to coach to this day. And away from my coaching, I'm also a senior performance scientist at British Weightlifting, where I work closely with the performance manager in providing performance diagnostics across all of our pathways. And because all of that stuff doesn't take up enough of my time, I'm also currently doing my PhD within the sport of weightlifting as well.
Yeah, is it okay to ask you about roughly about the topic?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, ask wherever you want, no problem.
In one sentence, what your PhD will be about?
Key performance indicators of weightlifting performance.
Okay, and we will leave it there because I think we will meet again and talk about it in details. But today I wanted
Okay.
to talk about the paper Weightlifting and Applied Method of Technical Analysis. It's a recent paper. I enjoyed reading it. It has a lot of goodness in it. So
Thank you.
why this paper was written and why it was needed?
The reason the paper was written is that there was this concept of stable and variable components, which I'll come on to in a little bit. And that's something that came up in a conversation with our education manager over at British Weightlifting. And it came to my attention that prior performance teams within the governing body had kind of used these stable and variable components to help identify technical errors within their coaching. Namely, these individuals were Giles Greenwood and Sean Joff as well, I believe, was part of this idea of developing this concept of these stable and variable components. And it was a really good concept, and all credit to them. But when the performance team changed ever so slightly, these ideas of the stable and variable components started being delivered in our education program. But me being brought in as a performance scientist, what I felt was lacking was scientific backing to see if some of these concepts being delivered were true based on the findings of the literature and, not just experience and knowledge of basic physics and biomechanics. But also, if you look at the author list, there's actually three nations that are part of this. There's British Weightlifting, myself and the performance manager, Stuart Martin. There's Greg Haff, who I think did some work with the Australian Weightlifting Federation and USA Weightlifting some years back as well. And Anna Swisher, who is the USA Weightlifting, I suppose, performance scientist and education manager, I believe. Apologies if I got the title incorrect. But you essentially have three nations agreeing on these concepts which we should follow to make weightlifting analysis a lot more easier. And I think it's a really nice step forward to normalizing the language that we use as weightlifting coaches and as scientists within the sport of weightlifting.
If you would have to explain almost like a definition, what are stable and what are variable components?
Yeah, so if we take the concept of a stable component in the context of weightlifting, consider these as kind of components of the lift which don't violate fundamental principles of biomechanics and physics. In doing so, you kind of run the risk of missing the lift, or at least increasing the likelihood of missing the lift. And these typically will relate to the bar center of mass relative to the body center of mass and the applied center of pressure as well. The variable component is where we kind of begin to be a little bit more accepting of individuals' anthropometries and differences, and how kind of different lifters will display the stable components. For example, someone with really long arms might not necessarily have the bar at mid-thigh during a power position during the clean, or vice versa. Someone with really short arms may have it close to the hips. So while this shows variance in both instances, the bar remains over the base of support and close to the body's center of mass. So the variable component doesn't violate the stable component, but allows for individuality when coaching individuals.
I think that the easiest way will be to go with examples. So if we could go through the positions with starting position and which components you would consider as stable ones and which one would be variable.
Yeah, sure. So if we go from the set position, and this is outlined in table 2 of the paper, in the set position, the stable components would be that the weight distribution will be on the middle of the foot. So you have your whole foot planted on the floor. The barbell should be essentially over the arch of the foot or over the first shoelace. And the armpit crease should be directly above the barbell. And the reason we use armpit crease is because it means the shoulder is in advance of the barbell. The armpit crease is directly above the barbell. Sorry, did you want me to go through all the stable components first and then variable, or stable, variable, and then the next phase?
Let's go through the positions.
So staying with the set position then, the variable components, which you might see during the set position, is the height of the hip relative to the knee. Often or not, a textbook example would be the hips should be higher than the knees, but this will vary depending on the lifter's anthropometry. So for example, if someone's got a very long torso and relatively shorter legs, they may sit their hips slightly lower in a point that the hip may be in line or ever so slightly above the knee. But that still allows them to keep their armpit directly over the barbell, which is a stable component. The other obvious variable component in the set position is the adoption of the foot position. So it'd be different widths and stances that would be adopted by the individual. And you know, you can see that when you look at different nations lift, where some may start slightly wider, some may start in a frog stance where the heels are very close together. And this kind of also falls under the style component as well, where individuals have different styles of lifting. We've now identified stable and variable components from the set, and now we're going to initiate the first, going into the first pull. So when we move into the first pull, the weight distribution at the end of the first pull, the weight distribution would slightly shift towards the heel. We're not going to say on the heel, because often or not, when you use a cue weight on the heels with the first pull, the toes tend to lift up, particularly with novice lifters. It's important to make a point of the whole foot should remain planted on the floor. So weight distribution may move back slightly. Barbell typically would move towards the lifter, although I believe this is more of a variable component now, because when you look at the literature, there are lots of different barbell trajectories that have been displayed by world champions and national lifters, and all of them have been successful. So I think upon reflection, bar moving back towards the lifter is idealistic, because it's moving towards the lifter's center of mass, but it could possibly be a variable component, certainly up for discussion. The armpit crease will now become in advance of the bar, and that's because you're extending the knees back. So as you extend the knees back and the shins become near vertical, your torso angle should remain the same as it was in the set. Because you do that, you're naturally going to have your shoulders more in front of the bar, so your armpit crease will then become over the barbell. This is really important to get this correct, because if the weight distribution of the feet moves slightly back, you push with the legs and extend the knees back to the point where the shins are near vertical, and your torso position remains constant, then you're able to elicit a stretch reflex during the transition, which is likely to occur based on the fact your quads and your hamstrings will be under a stretch. That's the importance of the first pull. And of course, a variable component will be the actual initiation of the first pull. So you have individuals who might use a dynamic start or a more static start. And just kind of jumping back to the set position, I think it's important to understand taking the slack out of the bar is also really important, because what that does is it reduces electromechanical delay. So we start higher up the force time curve, so we don't waste any energy or efforts being put into trying to lift that bar and overcome its inertia. So we're now at the end of the first pull. The bar finishes at around the knee, and the transition into power position occurs. So during the transition, the weight distribution will begin to shift from being slightly back to being slightly more towards the center. At this point, the knees will feed through the barbell, and the barbell should continue moving towards the lifter. So now your center of mass and the barbell center of mass are coming together. At this point, if you were to freeze frame at the end of the transition, you'll be in what we typically term a power position. And during this power position, the bar will be in contact with the athlete, and the bar will be directly over the base of support. So if you were to draw a line directly down, it'd be straight down into the middle of that foot. And typically that will just be, if you were to draw a straight line down from the side. And that will be a stable component, because you don't want your center of mass and the bar's center of mass to be disassociated. Now, the center of the shoulder will typically be directly over the center of the foot as well. Now, again, probably something that's up for discussion and upon reflection from writing this a few years back now, the arm bend. So the arm should typically stay straight and the force should be coming from the legs, although you may often notice individuals bending their arms to get the bar into a position that feels stronger for them to help them apply more force with the legs. As long as the athlete's not continually pulling with the arms, I don't think it's too much of a problem, but I certainly believe that's up for discussion and debate. Whereas if someone has a slight bend in the arm and has it then fixed as they move through the transition, although not idealistic, it may not be too much of a detriment to them. Variable components of that power position following the transition would be where the barbell makes contact. Now, like I mentioned before, somebody with longer arms may contact at a lower point, someone with shorter arms may contact at a higher point. And then we end our pull with, so I suppose, end of the second pull. And this is our triple extension. So the hip, knee, and the ankle should be extending really aggressively. The weight distribution in this instance will now move to the forefront of the foot to allow you to plantar flex. The shin angle will be again near vertical, maybe even slightly declined back. And in terms of a variable component, the displacement of the barbell relative to the athlete's center of mass may differ. Ideally, you don't want to have a big loop, because prior research has kind of mentioned a fair few times that minimizing the loop is important for a successful lift. The more the loop, the more likelihood of missing the lift. So the idea is to keep the bar, when you think about the stable components, keep the bar over your base of support for as often as you can. Keep it as close to your center of mass as often as you can. That's if you were to simplify it all down into two things for the pull. So now the bar's started to kind of travel upwards. We've got this point where the bar hits its peak, and we would have started turning over by then. But if we take peak barbell height as a point of interest, because it's easily identifiable, particularly if you've got like a software or something to measure barbell trajectory with. But even with a simple iPhone, you can see when the bar is kind of momentarily weightless. So during this peak bar height, the lifter should have already begun to get under the bar, you know, by flexing the knees and putting themselves into that squat position. Of course, the variable component of this will be the height at which the barbell is being pulled. That will vary depending on whether it's a snatch or the clean. Other variable components will be the displacement of the lifter's center of mass. So how high is the actual lifter during that point of the turnover? And the foot position. So some may adopt a slightly wider stance relative to their pull, or some may keep their feet the same. But that will vary on individuals' limiting factors of mobility, flexibility, and where they feel strong. Now we move on to the receive position. So the receive position is the point at which the barbell and the athlete connects. Okay, that receive will be where the velocity of the barbell starts to will be at zero, and then it will go into its lowest point in terms of its negative. Then as we receive this barbell and kind of meet the bar, ideally the bar should be over the base of support, so directly over the middle of your foot. So that's a stable component. If that happens, you're more likely to make that lift, because it's not in front, it's not moving too far back. Now, the height at which you receive the barbell will be a variable component. So if you think of your own lifts, if you think of when you do a power clean, you think of when you start putting heavier and heavier weight on, what ends up happening is you're providing they're all good lifts. The bar will always be over the base of support because you're making the lifts well, but the height at which you're catching the bar or receiving the bar, sorry, will alter.
If you know anything that could be helpful about drop height, that would be great.
Yeah. Okay. So essentially in the paper, what we've done is something which often probably gets overlooked, and we've defined peak barbell height, receive, and the catch. Typically, mm-hmm. when you get the research in particular, you'll see the peak barbell height and you'll see a catch. Now, if you imagine a lifter pulling the bar to X height and then dropping their body mass directly down into the lowest point of their catch, you've got this huge drop distance, right? And the barbell will then crash. So what ends up happening is the barbell's got that distance to develop some speed and on the way down. Whereas if we think about the receive section, the receive is where you begin to contact with the bar. So you essentially dampen that drop speed down into your catch. So a stronger lifter or someone that's able to lift very heavy loads will be able to do that far more effectively than someone who's, you know, maybe has this really large drop distance. So therefore you train elements that improve the receive, which will then filter down into a better turnover into the receive and into the catch. So it becomes a little bit more seamless. And it's just a way of kind of cushioning the weight coming down as opposed to the barbell crashing down on you.
Okay, so we are in a catch position now.
So we're in the catch. And this will relate to pretty much what you'd look for at the bottom of a front squat for a clean or an overhead squat for a snatch. But the stable components particularly will kind of translate into both. So the weight distribution ideally should be on the midfoot. So you don't want to be raising up on the heels or moving your weight too far back. And if you were to draw a line directly down from the bar, it should be over the middle of the foot. So directly over that base of support. Now, variable components will be the height at which you actually catch the bar. So some people may sit really deep into the hole because they have very good flexibility and very good strength. Some may not be able to do that, so they might sit a bit higher. And I think the most common one for being a variable component would be the foot position. So what foot position do people adopt when they catch? Naturally, your body will take the least path of resistance and will end up in the position where it feels strongest. So once we're in the catch, we've now got the recovery, where again, it's very much like the ascending phase of a front squat, overhead squat. The weight remains in the middle of the foot. Bar remains directly over the base of support. So if you drew a line down, it's directly over the middle of the foot. And we have to consider the technical constraints that the judges look for. So our feet have to finish parallel next to each other, can't have them like this or staggered. And of course, the variable component on this will be the width that you adopt and the foot position you adopt when coming into your recovery. Some athletes like to stand narrow, some would maybe go slightly wider, so wherever they feel like they have the most balance and support with the bar over their head or on their shoulder coming out of the clean.
Is there any metric you know coaches are measuring, but there is no evidence or the evidence is saying against using it?
There's not that I'm aware of, to be totally honest. Something I monitored was barbell displacement during snatches and barbell displacement during high pulls. And I also looked at peak barbell velocity, vertical velocity for block snatches and for full snatches as well. And didn't come to much conclusion from it, other than the conversation I could have with the athlete meant he could make the association between, if I'm creating this amount of speed, I think I'm able to snatch X amount at this time point. And we know load and velocity has a relationship where as load goes up, velocity is naturally going to go down. So it's, you know, it's a good predictor. One of the things I think it's important to be able to do is, especially in research, is try and standardize our definitions of phases. So typically speaking, the literature will use knee joint angle to identify the phases. So first peak is first pull, first or minimal knee extension will be the transition, and then second peak knee extension is the end of the second pull. And then you have the catch position, which is maximum knee flexion. But there's also other ways of doing it, which has been done since the 1980s, using the force time curve on its own. Some have used velocity. So it's really difficult to, although they're all very close to one another, I think we need to find a way of standardizing it. And that's something we've attempted to do in our lit review, which we're aiming to get at some point. But if you are using accelerations and velocities, for example, just be aware that it becomes difficult to identify the first pull, because not everyone has like a first inflection point on the velocity during the first pull, which is typically defined or has been used to define the first pull previously before it drops and goes back up. Some people have a continuous, quite a nice steady rise, and it's very hard to identify where velocity kind of plateaus a bit or drops a little bit, because it may not exist. And I think that's where I came to the realization that all these measures are really difficult to use within individuals sometimes, because each rep is different, maybe different, may display a different time series, acceleration time series or velocity time series. So that's what made me think I need to go and find out what is actually useful, what is not, what can be used to identify phases if we haven't got knee angle. Or just look at the paper. If you use a phone, you can pretty much identify the knee angles without even having the number. You can just do it frame by frame.
That's very useful. So are there any implications we haven't mentioned yet for coaches raising from this paper?
No, I think this paper kind of serves as a foundation for especially early career coaches to kind of help simplify the analysis process on what to look for, what to try and change or affect, whether that be through coaching cues or using special drills and exercises. At least they have something to go back to help identify key limiting factors. But I also think for the more seasoned coach, it kind of helps support some of the practices that we often overlook and take for granted with some sort of scientific underpinning. And really, to me, it's just important as a coach to be open-minded and critical of your own practice, like being able to discuss, justify, and defend your coaching is a really important step in kind of developing yourself, but also the athletes too, because ultimately it's them who we're disseminating our knowledge to through exercise selection or the coaching that we give them. And essentially this paper just aims to kind of simplify that process and hopefully aids in some sort of common terminology and languages adopted by coaches or those that use weightlifting for training.
Okay, so from here, where are we going? What is the future of research and what it means for coaches?
I think the future research for weightlifting in particular is going to be case studies. I think samples of elite individuals is really useful, but also maybe having an elite individual and having someone who's maybe a regional or a national lifter, for example, and just having some sort of indication as to the different things you can monitor with them or the different characteristics they have would be quite useful. I think that's pretty much it in terms of moving forward with the research. There's definitely more to be unpacked, but with such small sample sizes in weightlifting, it becomes very difficult. And then that's why I think you may find some things have a very consistent pattern within the literature, and other times it can be quite different depending on the sample size they've used and the samples that they've used and whether they've mixed men and women as well. It's also another consideration. And longitudinal studies, I think, is definitely needed in weightlifting. So longitudinal technical analysis, however you monitor that technical analysis, I think that's the next thing. Like, are we actually able to create change with our programs and our coaching in weightlifting? And can we evidence that longitudinally? We've done it with physical performance measures and usually some sort of proxy, so mid-thigh pull, jumps. But what about the technical elements and how does that all marry together? Then that's the next big step, which is missing from the research. And everything's a lot more accessible now, which is great. So now hopefully it's about finding out which of those metrics are useful, which are reliable, use them, monitor them, put an intervention in place. Does that intervention cause change? If it does, great. If it doesn't, why not? And once we can get down to that, then I think we're in a good place.
Okay, favorite color?
Oh, I've got to say, like a dark navy blue, probably, or black.
Okay.
But so, I've been told black's not a color.
Oh, it is. It is for infographics.
Brilliant. So I think dark navy is my favorite color.
Sure. Right. Noted. So your next infographic from your PhD paper will come from Evidence Strong in Dark Navy.
Thank you. Great. Brilliant.
So where people can find you?
So I'm on most social media platforms. So Twitter, Instagram, probably more so the weightlifting club's Instagram. I've got a little bit on my personal one, but I don't really use it too much. But I'm happy for people to contact me through either of those two means, Instagram or Twitter, and email as well.
Is my email your name? Platform. Your handle?
So, yeah, my Twitter handle is shy_2 and then tweet.
Okay.
And my Instagram is @coach_Chavda, which is my surname, Chavda. And my email address is s.chavda@mdx.ac.uk.
And club Instagram, did you say?
Yep. Club Instagram is, the handle is mdx_weightlifting.
Awesome. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure and fun to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, nice.
See you next time.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks, Alex.